Opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not necessarily reflect those of WREK Atlanta or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm your host, Pete Ledovis, and again, I am not joined by my ever effervescent co-host, Bill Hunt. He is back from vacation, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you thinking that Georgia Tech professors don't really do anything at all during the summer. But I believe he's at a conference in Washington, D.C., which would explain why sometime later this week, no doubt, the Homeland Security level will jump up one notch. Just a reminder, this is a live show, so during the second half of the show, we will be taking calls. If you've got a question or a comment for our guest today, please give us a call at 404-894-2468. And Trent, I'm assuming we'll be able to conference those people in.
We should.
I've got my fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Hopefully that's going to work. The title of today's show is The Patent Game, and that's a double entendre. Unfortunately, Bill's not here to experience that. He loves the double entendre, referring to the strategy of filing and maintaining patents to protect intellectual property, as well as an interactive simulation to test the strategy of patents and whether or not they actually help innovation. That was put together by our guest today, Andrew W. Torrence, who joined the Kansas University Law Faculty in 2005. He's a graduate of the Harvard Law School and received his Ph.D. in biology from Harvard University in 1997. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree from Queen's University in Canada. In 2003, he was the Hurdy. Is that Hurdy? Do I have that right, Andrew?
You've got it exactly right.
Okay.
No vowels allowed.
Oh, really? So there's no vowel in it at all?
No.
Sweet. All right. The Hurdy Visiting Professor of Conservation Biology at Harvard, and has taught biodiversity, science, policy, and law at Harvard since 1999. He's got a lot of interesting activities in the area of biodiversity and law that takes him all over the planet. But in particular, I am, let's see, what's the one I'm looking at here? Intrigued by the fact that you are the chair of the Scientific and Creative Board of the Darwin Project, a biodiversity institution plan for downtown Boston. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun and a lot of frustration at the same time. It's a group of folks in Boston, including a woman named Linda Haar and her husband Jonathan Haar. Linda used to run the Boston Redevelopment Agency, which is basically tasked with redoing Boston, like a big reno of the whole city.
Okay, these were the guys that tore down the apartment building I stayed in when I was in graduate school, no doubt.
Oh, my apologies.
No, it was about time, now that I think about where I used to live. So
they actually took my class in 2003 when I was teaching conservation biology at Harvard, and they liked it so much, it appeared, that they asked me if I would help them out, because they were planning on doing something in downtown Boston. Boston just buried a huge highway.
Mm-hmm.
The Big Dig cost, I think, every American something like $600.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of freed space now in downtown Boston, just prime space that they decided to dedicate to parkland. And they thought that biodiversity might be a nice theme for sort of a crystal palace with a rainforest inside and all kinds of educational activities to teach about global climate change and biodiversity. So, yeah.
Wow, so that's actually an excellent segue to today's Science in the News article, article, which comes to us from the New York Times, this Tuesday's Science Times issue, August 12th, 2008, by Cornelia Dean, entitled Handle with Care. And it really has to do with the fact that, you know, it's very, very hard to predict global climate change. All those models have a bit of uncertainty associated with them. So if we ever want to fix anything on a large scale, we ought to think about it long and hard. The article begins by pointing out that last year a private company proposed fertilizing parts of the ocean with iron in hopes of encouraging carbon-absorbing blooms of plankton. Meanwhile, researchers elsewhere are talking about injecting chemicals into the atmosphere, launching sun-reflecting mirrors into stationary orbit above the Earth, or taking other steps to reset the thermostat of a warming planet. And so you work in this, to some degree, in this area of biology. I mean, have you heard of some of the large-scale plans people are planning?
Yeah, I've heard these plans to essentially fertilize the ocean and create blooms that would capture the carbon dioxide, fix it into organic carbon, and then as the creatures eventually died, as they made their way to the ocean, it would go down to the bottom of the ocean and eventually be trapped and set.
Right. And I've actually seen just CO2 sequestered in liquid form at the bottom of the ocean because of the high pressure. sort of a scary thing, because nothing seems to grow in these large pools of CO2.
Well, absolutely. And there was this accident in Africa about 8 years ago where essentially a volcano burped CO2, and the CO2 silently went down the side of a mountain and wiped out every village it passed through.
Oh, yeah, just asphyxiated people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you sort of hope that once it was sequestered, it didn't make its way back up to the surface.
Right. So, I mean, not being a biologist myself, but purely from a scientific viewpoint, our theory is that large complex systems, and would you agree as a biologist that all biological systems are complex?
Oh, I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a chemical engineer, and we may have, you know, a 40-component distillation apparatus, but compared to biological systems, that's relatively simple. And really, for anyone that's an engineer or scientist, this is a sensitivity analysis thing. That anytime you change one variable, there's a real possibility, and when it's complex, a likely possibility, that you're going to change many other variables. And, you know, with a system as complex as the environment, tons and tons of iron, or tons and tons, and that's what it will be, you know, millions of tons of CO2 sequestration, is going to affect at least one other thing, and you don't know what that is. And I guess that's my general objection to, you know, large-scale fixes like this.
Yeah, I mean, I share your misgivings, and it makes me think of a gentleman named Bill Clark, who I got to know through my wife. My wife was doing her PhD in international environmental politics at the School of Government at Harvard, the same time that I was doing my PhD in biology. She got to know this gentleman, just a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he's one of the world's, I'd say, sort of foremost thinkers on the complexity of biological systems married to the complexity and the sort of perturbations caused by climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a really nice word. It's not even a very technical word.
We like non-technical words on this show.
Well, he's written a number of articles, just brilliant articles, and he's officially a genius. He won a MacArthur Award.
Mm-hmm. That is the definition, right?
That's right.
Money talks.
he wrote several articles on the concept of surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much, you know, coming into your house and being surprised on your birthday. It's the fact that when you're dealing with a complex system, even a system that's much less complex than most biological systems or ecosystems, you really cannot possibly understand the implications of changes to the system. And it's sort of delusional to think that you can. And so his suggestion is that humanity ought to think very, very hard about how they'll deal with surprises. In other words, how do you plan for unplannable events?
Right, agreed.
And I think this is exactly the category that he's thinking of. And I don't know what the approach is except caution and hopefully a lot more science before we do the so-called experiment.
Right, and basically the entire article, and you can check it out at the New York Times online, points out that we need centers that deal with these sorts of problems, engineering, and just the ethics, to think about it long and hard. And that's the answer. Think about anything carefully before you do it on a large scale. Because you're right. When we have a chemical plant and someone has a corrosion inhibitor that they want to put through the chemical plant and it affects every single pipe in the plant, they will test and think long and hard before they do it, because even that will change everything in the plant. And likewise, that's probably a good segue to today's topic, the patent system. Would you call the United States patent system a complex system?
I certainly would. Any system that involves human beings, especially government bureaucrats, is highly complicated.
There's the biological aspect. Well, so let's get started with what exactly is a patent?
Well, a patent is actually a fairly old concept. And a patent, in historical terms, is a right given by the sovereign, a king, for example, to give a citizen the ability, the exclusive ability, to do something. So nobody else is allowed to do something except the person who receives the patent.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, it evolved from being something that was simply given by the king to some favored subject, and one that I always use in my classes, Sir Walter Raleigh. When he returned from exploring the world, he was actually favored by Queen Elizabeth with a patent, and it was the most wonderful patent I've ever heard of. Mm-hmm. It was a patent on the, essentially, the examination inspection of pubs in the City of London, and they had to pass scrutiny by Sir Walter Raleigh. So I imagine he did a lot of empirical research just to make sure of the quality of inner-city London pubs.
Yeah, you told that story at the Berkshire conference where I met you, and I think that positively affected the happy hour that ensued. So.
Well, I'm glad. Over the years, patents turned away from that sort of personal patronage to being a way of encouraging technological innovation that didn't seem to exist in a particular area. So at first, it was given to foreigners who would promise to bring some skill. For example, the ability to dye fabric a particular color. Some colors are much more complicated than others to dye.
Right.
And so there were patents given out in the Low Countries in Europe, in Belgium and the Netherlands, to bring expert dyers into that area. They would then practice and teach their skills, and they'd be compensated by having a period of exclusivity where only they could produce that color. And then after that exclusivity was finished, anybody in Belgium and the Netherlands would be able to, having learned that technique, use it. And then it kept evolving and evolving. The most commonly agreed on sort of modern patent system, the first modern patent system, was in either Florence or Venice in the 14th and 15th century. And those systems gave a period of time, 7 years or 14 years. It's actually 20 years today in the States and most countries. And in order to get a patent, you had to show that you had some technological innovation that was useful. It was literally new, literally unlike any single thing that had ever been produced or published upon or described or sold. And it also had to have a little bit of a leap. It couldn't just be a small tweak from something that existed. It had to also have what the Europeans call an inventive step and what the Americans call non-obviousness.
Right, this is the non-obvious to one skilled in the art now that we use as the standard.
That's right. Today we reference a person having ordinary skill in the art, or some people call it a fozita. And the person having ordinary skill in the art would not be someone like you, Pete. It would be someone right in the middle of the bell curve of chemistry, not at the far extreme end.
And that would be the bad end for me.
Well, I wasn't saying that, but
it was very
you know better than I.
Of you. You're not, I'm not sure what, you know, outside the once in aviation you are, but you decide. All right, great. Okay, so then what you're saying is basically the patent from these patronage-type gifts from royalty have evolved into something that recognizes and we sort of assume helps to increase innovation, right?
That, I believe, is a fair statement. I think there's a lot, there's an assumption out there, and it's been out there for hundreds of years, and now it's through an international treaty called the Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property, part of the World Trade Organization. It's now spread to every country in the world almost. And the assumption is that intellectual property, patents in particular, are good because they create an incentive for innovators who would otherwise maybe be on the fence about what they would do with their lives. Maybe they'd go into chiropractic, maybe they'd go into comedy, or maybe they'd go into inventing.
Scary thought right there, yeah.
But because they have an incentive, the possibility of a monopoly over their invention, maybe they'll choose, more of them, to go into inventing, and we'll see more innovation come out of that.
Right.
Right in the Constitution, in fact, the U.S. Mm-hmm. Constitution, it says that Congress may come up with some sort of a patent system, quote, to promote the progress of useful arts. Mm-hmm. And so right built into the Constitution is this statement that to me implies, and I think to many people, they just assume that Congress is giving the gold stamp on patents leading to progress.
Right. But it seems logical, doesn't it? You spend years and years to develop something, and you get a chance to use that for many years exclusively, and it seems that that's only fair given the fact that this may have taken millions or billions of dollars. Take the pharmaceutical industry, right? It's hundreds of millions of dollars typically to develop a drug. It seems logical that that is a good motivation.
Well, so what you're saying, I think, is fascinating because you used two theories that are the two leading theories about why we should give patents, two leading philosophical theories.
Mm-hmm.
you said fair.
Right.
Now, fair sort of goes back to a guy named Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Locke said that if you do some work, and if you produce something using your work, that it's fair that you get some sort of reward. Now, he didn't talk very much about patents, but the idea with Locke would be that, you know, you spent all the time and energy, and why should everybody else be able to freely exploit your invention and you get no special recognition? That's the fairness side. And then you said the logical side. There's a whole different theory, the sort of utilitarian theory, that we want to make society better and better technology, including, for example, cures for diseases or more efficient, less gas-guzzling engines. That might be a good thing to have, and so in order to do that, we come up with systems to incentivize. And so logically, it seems that if you dangle a carrot in front of the inventor might wander towards the carrot and innovate more.
Right.
So yeah, those theories are out there, and I don't disagree with those theories. I just think that the story is probably more complicated than we suspected.
Yeah, agreed. Again, this is a typical complex system. Actually, before we talk more about this motivation aspect, which is the whole point of this interactive simulation called the patent game that you've put together, how have things changed in terms of patent law in the United States recently? Right? I mean, what are the current trends over the last 10 years in patent law? One thing I understand is it's extremely crowded, particularly in biotechnology. Right, there's patents overlapping on other patents, and you wonder about the, you know, whether or not one's enforceable or not, things like that. I mean, isn't that true that a lot of these things overlap and are quite crowded together?
It's the perception is certainly that in certain technical fields, software is actually the poster child for this, that there are so many different patented inventions out there, or patent applications waiting to reach the final stamp of approval from the patent office, that if you were to try and do almost anything in software, you'd run afoul of patents that you could have found and also patents that you never would have thought to look for, and that there's so many of these things that the whole field, as you said, is sort of tangled up. There's a phrase for that. It's called the tragedy of the anti-commons.
Right.
And the tragedy of the anti-commons creates a nice image that too much private property is a bad thing, which obviously appeals to, that also appeals to people whose particular political persuasions are sort of against the private property side, and sort of offends folks who are extremely pro-property. The interesting thing about the tragedy of the anti-commons, it has been suggested that there isn't such a tragedy for genes, for gene patents. And a lot of people who normally wouldn't pay attention to the patent system, people in the public, political officials, this has really caught their attention. And there's been bills in Congress trying to prevent this tragedy of the anti-commons in genes, because people equate genes with diseases and cures for diseases, and they don't want on the, you know, the road to the hospital, they don't want to have a bunch of roadblocks
And we're talking about DNA sequences, not the blue gene kind, in case Paris Hilton is listening.
Exactly. Just as far as I know, there is no tragedy of the anti-commons in blue genes. but in DNA genes, this has been suggested for about 10 years, and there's some very interesting evidence coming out now that it may, again, be more complicated than people imagined, and that this tragedy of the anti-commons may not work in the way that folks thought. So one of the worries was that researchers would not be able to do any research because companies who own gene patents would sue them.
Yes.
That does not appear to be the case.
Yeah.
It does not appear to be the case that researchers get sued.
But we are very concerned about that. With some recent changes in the laws, it is more restrictive for us academics. I'm trying to remember the name of that bill that you talked about when we were up in the Berkshires.
Oh, there's been a patent reform bill coming through the pipe every year for the last five years in Congress, and then it died again this year. I'm wondering whether whether you're thinking of a case called Duke versus Mady.
Maybe.
Where there used to be thought by many people, especially researchers, that they could do whatever they wanted in the confines of the university.
Right.
Because that wasn't really economic.
It was academic research, right.
Exactly. And so there was this thing called the research exemption, mm-hmm. from infringement. Now, a gentleman at Duke came up with a new type of laser, and then he left Duke. And Duke wasn't particularly interested in keeping the patent, so they let him have it.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept using the laser, and so he sued them.
Uh-huh.
And he actually won. And what mm-hmm. the court said was, this research exemption is really, really restrictive. It's actually just for philosophical amusement. But they said, you can't use it within your business. So they said, let's take a look at Duke University. What does it do as its business? Well, it's an educational institution. It teaches people as part of its business, and it does research as part of its business.
Mm-hmm.
And so the court said, essentially, if Duke is using the laser for teaching or for research, then that's its business, and it doesn't qualify for the mere philosophical distraction exemption.
Right.
That caused quite a chill in academia.
Yeah, yeah. Right, because in general, what we tend to do is we take anything and everything that we can get from industry and we use it on a small scale to see, can we improve it? And most of that's published in the open literature, right? So that is a commons attitude about sharing that research. But yeah, now we're even having trouble using it for fundamental research, and there are a lot of folks here that work in microelectronics and things like that. But you're absolutely right about the software industry. I was at a conference a number of years ago with Bob Rhines, founder of the Franklin Pierce Law Center, up in New England, and we were talking about the Franklin Computing case. This is when they first started debating the patentability of look and feel.
Right.
And that was the scariest thing I ever saw. You know, having a garbage can in the corner as your file, you know, bit bucket to get rid of things was suddenly now patentable. And to be honest, I never thought any of that stuff was patentable. To me, that's design, algorithm, things like that. But I've seen patents written on algorithms as well, so.
Well, you know, software has undergone this tortuous journey from unpatentability back in the 70s and early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
To copyrightability. So they tried to use copyright,
right.
But people can simply use a different language
mm-hmm.
to accomplish the same thing. Once they see the code, they can just work around it.
Right.
Copyright's not very good in that respect. Finally, patents were given for software in the U.S. Still controversial today. There's a book that just came out by two scholars, Moirer and Besson, who are at Boston University,
mm-hmm.
called Patent Failure. So that sort of telegraphs what they found in the book. But one of the things that they do look at length, and I think they analyze very cleverly, is software. They conclude that the costs of patenting in software vastly outweigh the benefits. And they find a lot of evidence that industry right now has internalized this message and has essentially decided that, look, patents just don't work as well in software as they do in other areas, and maybe they don't really need them, or certainly don't need them in the current form. And so software companies are getting together. They're forming what are called patent pools, where, you know, you license mine and I'll license yours, so there's a lessened risk of infringement. And they're also engaging in more and more open source and free software.
Mm-hmm.
Like IBM, for example, gave away a lot of its source code and appears to be making a fair amount of money from essentially open source code, which is almost the opposite of a patent. Anybody can use it and modify
it. Oh, okay. Actually, Brad, one of our engineers here, is asking me to ask him what is open source?
Yeah, what does open source mean? Because in our policy here at Inside the Black Box, we want to try and educate the people on everything. So
yeah, that's good. Absolutely. We all know what open source is because we're geeks.
There was a movement back in the 80s and the 90s against the proprietary protection, like patent protection of software. And part of this movement became what's called free software. Free software is you make some software, and then you make it available, for example, on the web to anybody who wants it.
Mm-hmm.
And those folks are allowed to modify it. But what they can't do is they can't take the software and then get a patent on the modification.
Right.
So it stays in a common pool, and the common pool gets bigger and bigger and bigger as more and more people contribute their innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Open source is a slightly more formal model. There's a license called the General Public License, and or the GPL. It's easily found on the web. Just look for GPL. And it has about 10 principles. And the principles essentially say, if you're going to use this software, you have to sign this license. What this license does is it copylefts to software as opposed to copyrights it. And it means that in perpetuity, you can't take this software and make it private or patented. It always has to stay public, and we'll use this license to enforce its non-patentability.
Right. All right, well, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, let's continue this discussion and talk a little bit more about the patent game and what this is telling us about the commons versus the anti-commons philosophy of these things.
Sounds great.
Okay. And when we come back and start a discussion, keep in mind, if you are listening, give us a call if you've got a question or comment in the second half of the show at 404-894-2468. I'm gone? No, I'm not gone. All right, you're listening to Inside the Black Box at WREK Atlanta.
There are very few things like music that can magically break the borders and barriers among the people and the nations of our planet. The Continental Drift Show on WREK utilizes this bounty to present the world as one country. Every Monday night at 10 on Continental Drift, we choose a country as a theme and play traditional and modern music from that country. Tune in to WREK 91.1 FM every Monday at 10 p.m. or online at WREK.org to listen to the world on Continental Drift. For more information about the show and upcoming guests, visit us online at ContinentalDriftShow.com. Listen to the world on Continental Drift.
Hi, this is your radio friend, Joe Bizard, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1 Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. We come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the Country Music Classics. Oh, happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the Country Music Classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. Love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
Do you like big band jazz? Then you love the DeSoto Hour. Every Saturday night at 7 on WREK. The best of the big bands and the small groups played with minimum talk on your favorite jazz station, WREK. The DeSoto Hour, Saturday nights at 7 on WREK, like we said.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about patents and patentability with our guest, Andrew Torrence from the Kansas University School of Law, a biologist and a lawyer. So what is that, the double threat at Match.com?
It's called spending too much time in school.
So the perpetual. So now, are you married?
I am married,
yes. You'd have to be a doctor and a lawyer, you know.
I'm not sure that follows, but...
Okay. And a guy who does way too much. So I don't know. Do we want to continue anything about the arcane details of open source versus free software? Are we going to confuse our listening
audience? It's not that important.
Okay. Well, in any case, I think what we're talking about here, and maybe we need to talk about this patent game that you've done, I think it's designed to look at, and this is the way you put it at that conference in the Merkshires, the commons versus the anti-commons. The commons is the philosophy of you share it all, and the anti-commons is you protect it with some sort of property definition, right?
Right.
And we always assumed, and you're right, I made the same assumption at the beginning of the show, that the anti-commons gives you a little boost for that sort of thing. But I remember talking to a guy in Robert Ryan's class when I was a graduate student that invented power steering, and he said he gave it to the government in World War II for tanks. And he never made a dime off that. Now, he did make some money off all the improvement patents and things like that. And I got to tell you, if you were a tank junkie in World War II, you probably appreciated power steering. So you designed something called the patent game to what? To analyze this idea?
Yeah, I was fascinated by this claim that patents promote progress in technological innovation. I was a patent attorney. I mean, I still am a patent attorney.
Yeah, in fact, you worked for one of the largest firms, right? Fish and Richardson.
Yeah, I worked for the firm that actually patented the airplane and the telephone and the telegraph.
Wow.
They've been around for a long time. I loved it. They're a top-notch firm, great people. But you don't really question the philosophy of patenting when you work for a patent firm.
Right.
But when I became a professor, one of the questions that intrigued me was, so what is the evidence that patents cause more technological innovation to occur than if they weren't there? And I absolutely blindly assumed there'd be lots of evidence. And in fact, I was simply looking for it at first to go in the first initial section of a paper I was writing just to back up the claim that patents promote progress. And I couldn't find it. And I asked some of my colleagues, and they said, look, this is a really, really complicated question, and we're not aware of any slam dunk evidence, either one way or the other. So I started to think it would be nice to find out whether it was true, especially since the U.S. patent system and the patent systems of about 175 other countries are based on this assumption. And patents are a big deal in domestic politics, and they're an even bigger deal in international politics. The trade rounds of the World Trade Organization that just ended in collapse last week, the so-called Doha round,
right.
Part of the reason it collapsed is that a lot of developing countries are rejecting the strong patent standards that the United States, Europe, Canada, Australia, the other industrialized countries are pushing. And they're saying, look, that might be fine for you, but it doesn't work for us. So it's actually a live issue, and I didn't think that it was. I assumed as a patent attorney that, of course, patents promoted more technological innovation. I felt like I'd seen that in the 4 years that I practiced at Fish, and I worked in-house at a biotech company after that. But it turns out that the best evidence I could find was actually a report by the National Academies of Science.
Mm-hmm.
It came out in 2003 called Patents in the Knowledge-Based Economy, and they also looked for evidence. And they concluded, in a rather stunning way, that, and I'm just quoting here from the report, the literature on the impact of patents on innovation must be considered emergent. And emergent is a sort of euphemistic way of saying...
Yeah, I know what emergent means.
We have no idea.
Yeah. We use that a lot in papers when we have preliminary results. So,
yeah.
Well, I got to say, I'm impressed because I actually participated in a National Academy of Science study on, you know, computing in the future, and I've read a lot of those studies. And I often wondered if any of them ever concluded anything that was ever of use before. And here's one. Yes! Yay for the National Academy of Sciences. Wow, that's great. So they're basically agreeing with your doubt.
Well, you know, my doubt came from looking for evidence.
Right.
Their doubt came from looking at everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that, there was some politics behind the commissioning of the study. And the Federal Trade Commission, another government department, they also... did a study that came up with a similar conclusion. There's a lot of people out there who are anti-patent, and there's a lot of people out there who are very pro-patent.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were trying to settle some of the claims,
right,
and see how patent policy in the U.S. should evolve in a more rational direction.
Right. So tell us about the patent game, this simulation that we played at this American Institute of Chemical Engineers conference where I met you, and I did quite poorly, actually. I'm a washout. I think I came in way behind Kevin Joback, who won the thing. So what exactly is it?
Well, there's a bunch of different ways that you can use computers to gather data, and I know that you know this quite well. You've done simulations in the scientific realm. You can have computers sort of chew their way through a particular model and come up with some results, but it's not interactive.
Right.
At all.
Right.
And oftentimes, if you understand the parameters ahead of time, you'll know what result you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
My colleague, Bill Tomlinson, who's at University of California, Irvine, he graduated from the media lab at MIT the same time that I was getting my PhD at Harvard. I used to hang out in the media lab, which is just an unbelievably fascinating place.
Yes, very wacky. I like it myself.
Oh, it's great. I mean, anyway, his specialty is taking real-world systems and trying to make them into games, make them into interactive simulations that people can play. And he actually started with a wolf pack. That was his PhD research.
Mm-hmm.
He did a virtual wolf pack. You put the 3D gear on, the virtual reality gear on. And then if you were a good wolf, you might rise to alpha. And if you were a bad wolf, you might get your throat ripped out.
Mm-hmm. Bummer.
Yeah.
This is in the cyber world, though, right? No blood was involved.
Exactly. That's okay. The cyber world. You actually survive the throat ripping.
Right, because with patent attorneys, I think actually more blood would be involved when you think about it.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. We'll get into the patent game in a second, but one of the first comments I got on it when I presented it to my intellectual property colleagues at a very, very...
I can only imagine.
Well, this very prominent patent scholar that I admire tremendously came up to me at the end. He had this kind of this big grin in his face, and he said, "Wow, this is really cool. I really like this."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "But there's one obvious flaw." And I got my pencil, I got my pen out, and I thought, okay, I better write this down to fix it. And he says, "Well, at the end of any self-respecting video game, you sever the other person's head and you hold it up dripping blood." He said, "You got to have that at the end of the patent hearing."
Don't they do that at the end of a patent hearing? I thought the Third Circuit Court of Appeals had approved that. You know,
it could be. It could be.
Okay, so he actually liked it then.
So he liked it, and a number, it's certainly caused some interest. There's obviously, there are things about it that people feel are not perfectly accurate, and we know that and acknowledge that.
In
designing a game, you have to play off having a million different parameters with having enough parameters that it's meaningful, but not so many that it's unplayable.
Right, and in fact, I just spent yesterday up at Solvay Advanced Polymers, and they do some neat stuff with innovation. They're probably going to be on the show in a couple months. But I was talking about computer simulation, the same thing I talked about at that conference where we met. And we realize there are assumptions out the wazoo. That's the technical term for it, out the wazoo. And that's okay, because even with those assumptions, if you learn something, if you get some insight, you may not have a perfect quantitative characterization of your model or of your system, but if you learn some insight about how it works, it was worth it. It was useful.
Yeah, I agree with that approach. And from the very beginning, what we say before we present the patent game at any conference, we say we are in a learning process here. It's an iterative process. We want to know what your comments are. We want to know how you feel it could be improved, because we designed it very flexibly using some open source software, actually, so that if we find out that there is a sensitivity, you mentioned sensitivities before, if there's a particular sensitivity that's pushing our results off into completely weird and inaccurate results, that we can go back and we can reconfigure it. Because ultimately what we want to do is we want to learn about the patent system by simulating it using human users.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still at the initial stages of that. I think that we've already learned quite a bit, but we would never for a moment say that we're finished the process of perfecting this. And I think, as you suggested, it never will be a perfect reflection of the real world.
Right.
There's a passage in Alice Through the Looking Glass that I always think of when I think of simulations like this. Alice is talking to a cartographer and a map maker, and she's trying to figure out what a great map is. And this cartographer is very enthusiastic about maps. And so she says, "So what makes a great map?" And he says, "Well, here's a great map here. On this map, it's large enough that I can see the whole country." She says, "But, you know, you're leaving details out." He said, "Well, I know, I'm leaving details out, and that bothers me. So here, look at this map. This is a close-up, and you can actually see the trees and the roads." She says, "But it's still not perfectly accurate, is it?" He says, no, you're right. So here is my perfect map, my dream map." And he shows her a map which is the same size as the real world.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And has everything in the real world on it. And obviously it's completely useless as a map.
Right.
So what we did in this game, we had sort of a back and forth. Bill said I could have six parameters or six sort of functional aspects, and I said, well, how about 200? And we eventually haggled up to seven.
Okay. Okay, so obviously he got the best of you in that negotiation. And you're the lawyer. What's wrong?
Well, the problem is I like him too much, so I didn't bring out the big guns.
Okay.
We ended up with basically a kind of a dashboard. And on the dashboard, there's a place where you can keep track of your money, because we, in at least one of the ways we use the game, money is the coin of the realm.
Mm-hmm.
So every player has their money, and they can keep track of that. Then there's what we call a design box. And the design box has a number of letters. We can make it symbols or numbers or anything else. But imagine A, B, C, D, E set out horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually drag any of those letters down into the inventing box. And you can make an invention A, B, C, or an invention C, D, B, E, or an invention C, D, B, A. You can change the orientation of the letters. So if you've got A, B, C, but you want C, B, A, you just flip them around.
Mm-hmm. And any combination, as long as it's unique order, is a different patentable concept, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, see, I missed that point. I thought if I had A in there, that was a claim from a previous patent, and I'd be infringing, and that's why I got killed.
So you were just that close to winning. Wow. Well, you have a choice once you make your invention. You have a choice. You can make it and sell it on the market for a certain price, or you can patent it first. And if you patent it, it will give you a rough idea of how much the invention will be worth on the market, and it costs you a certain amount of money and a certain amount of time to get the patent. We tried to reflect the real-world process, leaving out some of the mind-numbing frustration and passage of years that happens now in the patent office. Once you patent it, other players, if they make something that's been patented, they potentially infringe that patent. And the person who owns the patent has the choice of enforcing their patent, which means hiring a bunch of lawyers. And you can hire a few lawyers or a lot of lawyers. And lawyers cost a lot of money. I'm sure all of your listeners know that.
I did notice that in the game.
Yeah. So some people, if they really, really like their invention or if it's worth a lot to them, they can hire a lot of lawyers or very few lawyers if they don't care as much. So the defendant, the person who's infringing, they also have to hire some lawyers. And then we've got a little electronic roll of the dice, which takes into account the actual outcomes in federal court that deal with patents. So we try to reflect what your chances really were of winning or losing a patent suit.
Right, so you look at the average findings for infringement and against infringement and things like that.
Exactly, and if the plaintiff, the person who owns the patent, if they win, and if infringement is found and if damages are awarded, in patent law, you can owe up to three times the normal damages. It's called treble damages.
Right.
So if you're really, really bad, if you know perfectly well that what you're doing infringes, and if you're aware of that, and you go ahead and do it anyway, it's called willful infringement, and you can be punished up to three times. So we reflect that in the algorithm in the game.
Right.
So sometimes you get devastating awards against you, and sometimes you get light awards.
Well, so I'm not sure you're doing it justice. You have all this ability to fight it in court or infringe or not infringe. You can license other people's patents before
you
manufacture. You can sell your patents. But you're making it sound like a snooze fest at Andy Taylor's house with Aunt B, you know, pouring, you know, tea with the pie. I mean, this was like a bunch of dingo dogs going after, you know, some carcass out in the Australian outback. You know, the engineers, it was a frenzy. They were buying, they were selling. I mean, it's actually like an interactive game of Monopoly where people were, you know, turned on you like a pack of dingoes. It was actually very exciting.
Well, I'm glad that you glad you liked it. We've used it with a bunch of different groups of people now, and the one common element that makes both Bill and me really happy, although it won't lead to any academic credit whatsoever in our careers,
of course,
is that people always beg us afterwards if they can keep playing.
Well, my question is it still true that grade school kids do better than patent attorneys on this thing, or has that changed?
Well, we had some early evidence using, you know, a fairly select group of 8 to 11-year-olds, usually just the sons or daughters of friends, who play the game against me or a couple of other law professors or other adults. And as soon as they know what the rules of the game are, they don't even need to know what the patent is.
Right. Right.
In fact, you don't even have to call it a patent. You can call it a, you know, an X.
Yeah, exactly.
But they know what the rules of the game are. They very, very quickly figure out how to do well in the game.
Right.
And yes, so we had some real thrashings by folks that really ought not to be able to do well in the patent.
And should I call the Harvard Alumni Association and report this to them? Maybe your degree isn't as worth what they thought it was. I don't know. Well, so here's my question. You've got this interactive game that's a model, you know, it's a course model that's designed to learn something about this commons versus, or actually the theory of the commons versus anti-commons. Is that the hypothesis you were trying to test?
Yeah, because we have three versions of the game. Actually, we have more than three versions, but one version of the game is pure patent. You can get a patent or not. It's up to you. Another version of the game is no patents whatsoever. We call it the commons.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have a third version that we perfected after you played the game this summer, mm-hmm. in which we incorporate the idea of open source. You can actually take an invention and make it open source, which is like anti-patenting it.
All right, Trent's nodding. He's a software engineer. Are you a fan of the open source stuff, Trent?
Yeah, I use it every day.
Okay. Well, but here's the thing. You know, engineers, we like the open stuff because that helps us with our curiosity. But the goal of your game is to make money, right? At least the version I played.
That's one of the measures that we use. Although I have to say, just in defense of the game, we have an SQL database, a big, big database that collects absolutely everything that happens, including every keystroke and the time between keystrokes. So it's true that we keep track of money, but we can also look at a lot of other things that are going on.
Oh,
you could even turn the money off.
You could trace my breakdown in round two.
I never reveal that on the air, though.
Well, so here's my question. Because we're getting near the end of the show, what have you learned from this interactive simulation?
Well, this is the really interesting thing. I had to apply to the Institutional Review Board at the University of Kansas, which is what you do when you want to test a drug on human subjects.
It's a very extensive, I have to do it myself, bunch of forms that you have to fill out, because you're using human guinea pigs, essentially.
Exactly. I actually used first-year law students who were just starting off in the summer. They'd never taken intellectual property before. I paid them $10 an hour.
Wow, that's sweet.
Yeah, they were officially my research assistants. They paid $10 an hour, and there was a prize awarded for every single game. We got this from the business literature, which suggests that you need to compensate your subjects in economic experiments like this, and you need to have a real incentive to play your heart out.
Right.
So we did this, and we ran a bunch of trials. So over the course of the summer, I seconded a courtroom in our law school, and it became the gaming room, which caused a lot of interest from other professors wondering why people were playing video games. We gathered data, and we used different flavors of the game. We used the patent version, the commons version, and then the version that has open source and patenting capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
We ran a bunch of these games. We kept everything constant between the trials that we compared, except for patents available, open source and patents available, and no patents available. And we gathered data, and we analyzed it, and I've presented it at a couple of conferences now, one in Europe, in Finland, about 3 weeks ago, and then one down at Harvard and MIT last week. We actually came up with fairly stunning results, results that stunned me.
Right. Unexpected.
They were very unexpected from my perspective, yeah.
And what were those results?
Well, what we found was I'll talk about sort of three different things we measured. One is what I called innovation. It's the number of unique inventions that were created in a period of time in three different treatments, the patent open source, and pure common.
Mm-hmm.
I expected, let me just tell you my bias, I expected as a patent attorney that we would find many more inventions created in the patent system.
Yeah, so would I, based on our conversation earlier.
Yeah. Now, what I actually found was that in the pure commons system, in the period of time that we ran the trials for, roughly 103 inventions were invented per game, versus in the patent system and the patent open source system, which were essentially behaved the same, 77. So 103
mm-hmm.
versus 77.
Mm-hmm.
And we analyzed this statistically, and it's statistically significant, which means that the data really is different. It doesn't just look different superficially. It really is different mathematically.
Right, so statistically significant for our listeners, basically, the variation between those two cases is much bigger than the variation within them, whether they're testing third graders or patent attorneys and things
That's right.
That's basically what that means. We could do a whole, we'll do a whole show on that one of these days. Brad's getting excited about that.
That'll be a snooze fest, I guarantee.
Okay, so...
The second thing we looked at was the number of things that were made and used in a period of time. So they didn't have to be unique inventions. It was just basically the economic activity.
Right.
Now, that one, the results were stunning because the difference between patents and non-patents, it was a doubling effect. There was 658 things made or sold in the commons.
Right.
And 322 things made or sold in the patent or patent open source.
Right, that's big.
It's very big. The final measure we did was what we call social utility. It's basically wealth per player, the amount of money made per player. Now, in that case, we found that the difference was $41,200 per player in the commons versus $10,200 in the patent system. So, huge. Huge difference. So, yeah, those results were sort of the flip side of what I expected, and it really made me think a lot about what's going on here. We don't know that it reflects reality. But what's interesting is I was just at this this Harvard-MIT conference last week, and I these folks study what's called user innovation and open innovation. So innovation that doesn't involve things like patents.
Right.
And there's a lot of people there that believe the patent system is actually a drag on innovation in many fields.
Right, which is what your results kind of imply.
Right, and so I wouldn't say that there were a lot of surprised people there, but there were a lot of people who said, wow, this confirms what we've seen in the empirical, not so much empirical in terms of data, but looking at case studies. So I thought that was really interesting. They thought the results were consistent with what they see in the open innovation world out there.
So here's my question, and I want you to think about it. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back in a few minutes. So it suggests that maybe the commons approach is better. My question to you is, what's the logic behind that? What's the mechanism? What's the explanation for why we would innovate more without the patent system? Because that's counterintuitive to basically everything we said.
Sure.
So think about that. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to WREK Atlanta. And if we have time after the break, we can maybe take a call or two. Again, you can reach us at 404-894-268. We'll be right back on Inside the Black Box.
On the first Sunday of every month, tune into WREK for the iDrum Archive Sunday Special. Drawing from years' worth of performances at the Downtown Performance Space, you'll hear improvisational jazz, electronic, punk, and all sorts of music captured live. For more information about iDrum, visit their website at www.eyedrum.org. Again, that's the iDrum Archive Sunday Special, the first Sunday of every month at 7 p.m. right here on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
Tune in Saturday nights from 10 p.m. to midnight for the best in local electronic dance music. Spanning the genres of house, techno, trance, breaks, drum and bass, and everything in between, EDM Sound System is your one-stop shop for all things electronic dance music. EDM Sound System, broadcasting Saturday nights right here on WREK Atlanta.
There are very few things like music that can magically break the borders and barriers among the people and the nations of our planet. The Continental Drift Show on WREK utilizes this bounty to present the world as one country. Every Monday night at 10 on Continental Drift, we choose a country as a theme and play traditional and modern music from that country. Tune in to WREK 91.1 FM every Monday at 10 p.m. or online at WREK.org to listen to the world on Continental Drift. For more information about the show and upcoming guests, visit us online at ContinentalDriftShow.com. Listen to the world on Continental Drift.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta, where we're talking to Andrew Torrance from the Kansas University Law School about whether or not patents really help. And basically, your preliminary results indicate that maybe the commons approach, where we don't have lots of patents, can actually increase innovation. And Brad, one of our engineers and mechanical engineering major, is chomping at the bit here.
Andrew, I think that a patent is made for economic reasons, to protect your property, your intellectual property. That way you make money off it and no one else can take it. Whereas if you open source it, or let it be free into the economy.
The commons idea.
Then innovation will occur because people then can use it, and then there's not that economic
The driving force is missing.
Yes.
Right, so the question is, will we get twice the innovation, which is kind of what your results imply, but nobody's going to be making money off of it, and the economy will crash, we'll all be, you know, living in huts in the backyard.
Well, what I would say is that these results are surprising. And they're surprising for a number of reasons. They're surprising because they don't follow the conventional economic logic.
Mm-hmm.
Conventional economic logic is that private property gives the owner an incentive to improve their property.
Right.
And in the intellectual property context, you know, patent gives you an incentive to exploit your invention, and maybe gives an incentive to the folks I talked about before, the folks who are sitting on the fence, to actually go into inventing.
Right.
So this doesn't fit the conventional economic logic, but there's a lot of innovation that is known to go on outside that conventional economic system anyway.
Stuff that is
not controversial in the sense that we know that it's out there, and it's sometimes people do it because it enhances their reputation. Somebody comes up with some great new invention, dedicates it to the public, but makes sure that people know that it was, you know, her that came up with it. That person may, in the future, be called upon to use their exceptional, you know, innovative skills to make money by working for another company that has some particular project that they need someone clever to work on. There may also be a whole field of innovation that's just not been measured by classical economics. One example is windsurfing. And at the conference I was at last week, windsurfing was a common example. In windsurfing, it was not companies that came up with the windsurfer in the first place, or innovations like foot straps, or innovations like ways of jumping off of waves, or being towed. All of these innovations came from the user community.
Right.
And they spread like wildfire. And what's interesting is the more innovations that the user community came up with, the more follow-on innovations there were. And eventually, companies caught on and they'd say, look, these foot strap things, I think they're the wave of the future. So they'd make foot straps.
Right, but then the guy who invented them may not be making the money off of it.
May not be making the money off of it, but he may not need to make money off of it in the conventional way. It may be that he makes money in different ways. Sort of like rock musicians now don't make money from record contracts, they actually make it from touring.
Yeah.
Maybe he makes money because he is always known as the guy who came up with the foot strap, and people want him to, you know, give interviews to newspapers, or they want to have him on the radio, or they want to have him in some competition, or they want to have him teach his, you know, his skills to folks for money.
Right.
There's myriad ways in which you can make money outside of this conventional make an invention, patent it.
Brad remains unconvinced here.
I'm missing where the patent is the driving force in innovation. Like I must have missed that, but to me, it seems like the patent isn't necessarily what's going to drive people to innovate more. You know, because let's say you own a piece of real estate, you own a house, right? You own that house. Let's say it's an idea or whatever it may be. You don't want to change that house because it's already making you money. So you might move on to something else and do something else. But that one piece of house is just going to sit there and make you money.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Go ahead, Pete.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of what he's saying, is that the patent isn't the motivation to innovate anymore. And I have seen that, actually. Internal to companies, you get the best innovation when you no longer have that competition internally to file patents. There's competition within companies to get the number of patents that you are inventor on. Obviously, the company's the assignee, that sort of thing. So I can see that it would spur innovation. And economically, here's the new model I see. The stuff is out there to one degree or another in the public domain. That means anybody who has a good idea on how to manufacture it, improve the quality of it, these sorts of things, can go off and start a business. And I think most of us have seen this model. The guy that invents it is usually not the guy that makes the big money on it. He may have the patent. He may start manufacturing it. He does a good job. He makes, you know, a fair amount of money. But it's the next guy, the innovator, that even 20 years later realizes how to make it better, how to make it appeal to the average person, you know, that sort of thing. And let's face it, I think we're catching up in the United States here, but for a while, when quality was really the purview of Japanese engineers, the reason people were buying Japanese cars is they, you know, there wasn't anything new or novel about them. It was just tolerances and quality for a while that was really, really good. And I think that's changed a lot in the United States. I think United States auto manufacturers have really done a lot in the last few years to even that out. But it wasn't innovation. It was simply manufacturing and distribution and things like that.
And Pete, just to echo what you said about quality, this is something that I've wondered about in the past. I mean, as a person who buys cars and who wonders why the American industry isn't doing as well as folks hope, when you buy a Toyota or a Honda, you're not buying a bunch of patents. You're buying a psychological guarantee that that car is going to run, and it's going to run well.
Yeah.
And it's non-proprietary. It's a reputational thing.
Right, right. And that's kind of what you alluded to before, that software engineer is going to gain a reputation and therefore, you know, income from that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the flip, you know, the acting at the same time is a different force, which is there is growing empirical evidence that parts of the patent system aren't functioning the way that they're intended to function. They're actually costing more than they are giving benefits to the economy.
They are expensive and slow, and they do impede innovation. I've seen it firsthand. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Now, one curious little sort of harbor here is biotechnology. There is some fairly good evidence, including this book, Patent Failure, that in biotechnology, especially when you're talking about a single drug, that the patent system may actually still work well. And my game doesn't test different forms of technology.
Right, right.
And obviously my area of patents was biotechnology. I wouldn't be surprised if what we find is that the patent system works better for some technologies, worse for others. And what I think one of the insights that we've come up with from our game, I think, is that perhaps we shouldn't think of technology as monolithic. Perhaps we should fine-tune the system of innovation that we have to reflect that different technologies have different requirements.
Agreed, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. It's very, very different. And that the pharmaceutical example was the one I was going to bring up. Clearly, in chemical process patents, where I work, very few patents are filed relative to other industries because we do it as a trade secret.
Right.
If it's a process patent, you keep that process secret. The product produced is the same, and it's very hard to figure out the process from the product, whereas if it's a single molecule for a drug, what binder you put it in there, how you deliver it, the sorts of stuff, I mean, that can be varied out the wazoo, again, to use the technical term. But, yeah, once you look at the molecule, and people don't realize that a lot of drugs are very simple molecules.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's ironic that people don't really respect patents too much in the chemical process industry. It's not a part of our culture, but in the pharmaceutical industry, they do. So.
Well, and, you know, there's another feature of pharmaceutical and biotech, which is, I think, different than a lot of other technological areas, which is once you've come up with the drug, even once you've got the patent, then the real expense begins. And that expense is convincing the government that your chemical can actually be given to humans in a safe way, and that costs billions of dollars. In that case, if a patent doesn't inhibit innovation, the tipping point might be the fact that you really need that monopoly to justify the input of $1 billion in regulatory fees.
The bureaucracy of that approval.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so let's wrap up here. Let me ask you the question. So given what you have so far and the fact that these are preliminary results, they're just giving us insight, this patent reform bill that comes up every year or so in Congress, what would you put in that if you had a chance to do it? Or would you leave the system the way it is now?
I think that I would not leave the system the way that it is now. And rather than a specific reform, what I would do is I would try and set up a monitoring system for different technologies that tries to tease out what's working and what's not working.
Right.
Now, that's as crude as my economic simulation is. But I think that thinking of the system as a single monolithic system, one size fits all, I think that's clearly wrong.
Right.
And I think that if the goal is technological innovation, we should be studying the patent system constantly with simulations like this, but also all sorts of other ways, and trying to fine-tune the system so that what we achieve does maximize the benefits over the cost. Because I have no doubt that innovation is a good thing, at least in most respects, although Plato was against innovation. He thought that it would change society, and because Athenian society was perfect, he didn't want it to be changed. But I disagree. I think we need more innovation. We need more drugs. We need better fuel technologies, better cars.
I think Trent needs some drugs right now, actually. But yeah, Athens may have been perfect, but we certainly aren't here. All right, so I would agree with you. Let me see if I can recap what we've learned, right? So our current patent system sort of evolved from the original system in Florence and Venice, which was sort of giving an incentive or a reward for people that innovated. And we have assumed, lawyers, geeks like myself, yourself when you started looking at intellectual property law, that this anti-commons view, this rewarding of property rights for innovation, was a good thing and increased innovation. And what you're finding is that your simulation is suggesting that, well, maybe it's not the case, right? Maybe it's just the opposite, that innovation would be increased better in more of an open commons type environment. But more importantly, that not every piece of technology, not every area of technology is the same, right? Pharmaceuticals may be very different than software and may be very different than the chemical process industry, right?
Yeah. I think that summary is patently correct.
Wow. So I actually got something right. Well, I thought that was fascinating, despite the fact, why don't we have any callers, Trent? What the heck's going on here? I don't know. It's maybe Trent being half asleep. I don't know.
Well, I might have a reason for no callers. There's an old joke in the patent field that patent attorneys are like tax attorneys, but without the great personalities.
No, trust me. I've met many intellectual property attorneys, and you are the Shecky Green of intellectual property attorneys. So, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thanks very much for having me. It was an honor.
And for our listening audience, thank you for joining us this week on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier. We'll be back next week on WREK Atlanta.